Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Logia Books podcast, episode 2. Today we are here, well, I am here with Fori Banu, Fori Samson Banu, who will be talking to us about his debut novel, 8 Years, which is a political fiction novel, and it's going to be live on our website, available to order from Monday, June 12th. Anyway, so let's start with, for you, just give us a quick summary of the book, without spoilers, for anybody who hasn't gotten to it by the time this is live.
Okay. So 8 Years is a novel about a fictional Nigerian presidency, and it's sort of the format of it, or the way it's laid out, is sort of intertwined with the plot and the characters and everything else about it. So it's done over a period of a year, and it's set in 2011 or 2011, if you prefer. And yeah, it follows a year from the inauguration on May 29th to the next year. So it's a year in the life of the presidency, day by day, from various angles, through various viewpoints, through various characters. And yeah, that's what it is. The idea is to present a progressive presidency in the ideological sense, like a president, a center left or slightly more left version of a Nigerian presidency, interested in the more social aspects of governance, interested in lifting people out of poverty and using Nigeria's resources for Nigerians, and that sort of viewpoint of governance. So yeah, that's basically, I feel like I've described this very badly.
Well, you've described something.
But yeah, that's the idea.
Well, okay, so your description right now sounds very politics heavy, sounds very government heavy, which it is in a lot of ways. But I'm going to come back to that description later on to talk about some other aspects of it. First, I want you to talk to us about how long, because it's a pretty substantial book. Like you said, it takes place over the period of a year. So it's several hundred pages long. So how long has that whole concept been in your mind, especially considering this is just the first volume of the series?
Okay, so first of all, you said several hundred pages. You know exactly how many pages that book is.
It's 900-ish pages. I just said several hundred.
You're afraid to say how long.
I don't want you guys to freak out. I know we don't like to read anymore. I know our attention spans have dipped significantly. Yeah. It's 900-ish pages long, but it's 900 very engaging pages is the thing. So anyway, let's talk about, first of all, how long it's been on your mind, and then we'll go into all of that.
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, because it's always an idea in your mind about any particular thing. How long it has been in my mind as a book, I can only trace back to 2017 when I first wrote the first page. But I think long before that, I'd been grappling. Sometimes you get an idea to do something artistic or otherwise, or something creative, let me not say artistic, and you don't do it because you think it's daunting. You say like, oh, someone should do an album of songs in the major key F. If that's the thing. I know nothing about music, so that sounds
off.
And then you think about it, but after a while you're like, no, someone really should do it. And then you look around and you're like, no one doing this album in this key. Doing albums in this key. And then after a while you go, you know what? I should do anything. And then you write it and you try and make it a community thing. Try and say, okay, let me get a group of people together and say, let's make an album in this key. And then from there, no one is interested, no one gets it, or they are just busy with their own lives. And it's not the idea, they don't care about the idea, which is fine and fair, because it's only in your head, this obsessive thing you're trying to do. And then you sit down and you're like, okay, I'm the one that's going to do this album. And you start making it simply out of compulsion and fear and some strangled fire and the idea that if you don't do it, you can't move on to the next thing that you want to do. So yeah, so 2017, I wrote the first few chapters and tried to sell it to any person that would collaborate with me, and didn't get any takers at all. And then obsessed with doing it for a while and then got back to writing it in various spurts across the years until it crystallized into, yes, I should actually finish this because it is a thing I have to do before I do the next thing.
Okay. Well, you started off by talking about 2017 and how that's when you first started putting pen to paper, in a manner of speaking. So how long would you say it took altogether with the spurts and the start and the final like product of what you're ready to present to someone?
So let's say January 2017 to April. April 2023.
Wow. Okay. Fair
enough. I think that's probably when I was able to send it to the editor, was to say it was April 2023. I can't remember if that's even accurate, but yeah.
I think that might be.
So it took that long of a stretch. And the intense writing was probably 3 years.
Yeah.
And then the thinking about it, but it was always on my mind. It was that seed that just kept on growing and growing and growing and growing. And before you knew it, my head was a tree. And I could not get out of writing. I'm making it sound reluctant, but no, I enjoyed writing. It's not a reluctant thing. But I'm trying to pick up the compulsion of writing, the idea that, oh no, you have to do this or nothing else will happen.
Okay, so the main character, the president which this presidency sort of evolves around, or revolves around rather, is a character called Richard Adewo Williams. He's a truly compelling character. He really is a captivating character, and with all his flaws, his ups and downs, everything.
Yeah.
Who is this man? Where did he come from? Tell us about him.
So, okay, there are several things that happen with Richard. First and foremost, it's from, I mean, I speak a lot about West Wing because West Wing is the first thing, the first creative thing that I saw that had that sort of idea that I've always had in my mind. I've always been interested in governance. I've always been interested in what a president would be like if he was progressive. And West Wing, that I watched peripherally over the years when it was on, and then settled down and watched, binge watched it after it had stopped showing for a number of years because, you know, Nigeria and discs. So, the president in the West Wing is called Jed Bartlett, and that's the first form of the president I was trying to form. Just an idealistic, but practical sort of the Bartlett character, as Aaron Sorkin wrote him, is complex because he's moral and or does immoral things. He's brilliant but can be naive. He's idealistic but can be mad practical at any given time. But I wasn't interested in that kind of character because I'm not sure how well that translates in terms of his own background into our own peculiar history and what that would mean. So the only thing that ended up being the same, between that character and this character was their academic background. I think Bartlett is a professor of economics and ours is a professor of history, which I thought was just more germane to what the sense of history of Nigeria and what that would mean. And then from that point on, I think I just made him up because I wanted him to be young, in his 40s, youngish, because I wanted him to be separate from the typical president we would have in Nigeria. And I wanted him to be set in a particular time, so it was 2011. And in 2011, we had a South-South president, and I wanted to explore that idea. In order to add to him those elements that sort of brought President Jonathan into office, the idea that he was a deputy and then a vice president, and that all these elements of providence gathered and steamrolled him into being president. And there's a line in West Wing, I promise you the last time I go to mention West Wing in this podcast, where Toby says to, I think he's speaking to Josh, and he says that the president must believe that all the forces in the universe have colluded to make him president. And that is the idea behind William. I wanted it to seem like, much like Jonathan, it seemed like everything had worked in his favor. Tragic events and non-tragic events had come together to create this moment in history. And that, because of that opportunity, because it bucked the system and it went against the established order of the way things were supposed to go in Nigeria and in our fictional Nigeria also, I thought that would be a ripe avenue for reform. So William Richard is that agent of reform in the sense that he's not soiled in politics as we see it. And he comes from, even though he is long enough in politics to be called a politician, he doesn't see himself that way. And more importantly, no one sees it that way. And he is a lonely character because I wanted to show the isolation of power. And he is a sensitive person in the sense that he feels things, he's empathetic. In that sense, because I remember I have this friend, Kofume, and we were in a WhatsApp group together, as you do, and somebody was talking about what kind of president Nigeria needs. And he said the most important trait of a president is empathy. And he got like maligned for that in the group. Everybody was like, that's just dumb. No, you need competence. But it always stuck with me. And I said, no, he's absolutely right. The most important trait to lead people is empathy, to lead people correctly and effectively is to understand or want to understand where they are coming from and how to serve them. And that's the most important thing about Richard is his empathy, that he feels for things that he doesn't even understand. He feels everything is his fault. And he feels like he has to do something or the world will fall apart. That's megalomania also. I shade it over that the empathy is more than that. So he is empathy within the Nigerian context.
Okay. So I want to talk a little bit more about the other characters in book, specifically the women in the book. Although they're not altogether like the principal characters of the book.
Yeah.
Because really, when it comes down to it, the focus, the principal character, since we're talking about presidency, is in fact the president.
Yes.
But there are all these other characters that are supporting characters, in some cases major, in some cases minor. And the women make up a good portion of that. But you created women of every shade. Like every single kind of woman you can think of sort of manifests herself in the book some way or the other. And I want you to talk about the women and I want you to talk about the inspiration behind the women.
Okay, well, I think I was in many ways raised by women because in the generation I grew up in, and I don't know what our generation is doing about it now, but mothers were the central point of your interaction with your family. And in most cases, we come from the broken home generation, the generation where in the 80s, I think a lot of familial bonds were broken by there were a lot of single parent or multi parent households, so to say. And in many cases, the mothers were the ones who stayed. And in that sense, I grew up around mothers. Ironically, in a personal sense, I actually didn't grow up around my mother, but I grew up around women. And I've always been fascinated by that, by their character, by their viewpoint, because there's a sense in which you can't really understand what it is like to be a woman until you have walked in her shoes. You can't, I'm not sure. And in the same way, men say, oh, women don't understand what we go through. Mm-hmm. But men definitely don't understand what women go through. and through having sisters, through having mothers, through having friends, through having lovers, through having a wife, I understand that bridge. I don't understand them, but I understand the bridge that separates us in the sense that, oh yeah, what we take for granted as men may not be overly granted to women in the sense of how they exist in the world. And so I was trying to celebrate that aspect of being a woman in Nigeria and make all of them powerful and independent and with their own agency in as much of a sense as I could. Within the context of not creating a fantasy,
yeah.
out of that, out of their thing. But So I'm just always interested because I think one of the things that's interesting about a writer is to enter places where you don't know naturally. And a woman's psyche and a woman's journey or pilgrimage in the world is not something I understand. I'm always trying to understand it. And that's why I think I write a lot of female characters, because I'm always trying to understand, especially the women I know and the women in my life and the women around me. I'm always trying to understand why, what happened, why, you know. And people always complain that, yeah, for every time you ask me a question, you say, well, what happened? And what did you say? And what did he say? And what? But it's just how my mind functions. I need to understand it. So yeah, so I wanted it to be a celebration of women in that sense, to say, oh, this is part of, and I don't think that. I think that it's, you can't have one without the other. You can't remove a gender before we enter into gender politics. Yes, I mean, whatever your view of what gender means and what sex means and all of that stuff, you can't remove one from the other. The balance of the world and the sort of fabric of the world is sewn into the duality or multiplicity of viewpoints and experiences and lives. And I couldn't write a book about a president without showing the women that shape him in that sense. And that's what I tried. I think that's what I tried to do. I tried to surround him with women that were strong. I'm trying to think of if I made any woman not strong. But everybody's strong in their own way. It's just the day you meet them. And since we meet them on days, I try to show them in their strong days, not their weak days. And if their weak days are just versions of their strong days in any sense. So yeah. So that's what I hope came across in that sense, that I'm celebrating that aspect of what it is to be human. Just the feminine side, so to speak.
Okay, so the other thing that I was really intrigued by when it came to character development in the book, and that's why initially in the beginning when you were talking about the book and you're describing it, I said this sounds very politics heavy and it sounds very governance heavy, but the book isn't all of that because a good portion of the book is the mundanity of interpersonal relationships sometimes.
Yeah.
And I think that it does a great job of humanizing characters because if you remember from when I personally was reading the book in the beginning, there were characters where I was like, this person is so annoying,
Yeah.
this person is so this. And then by the end of the book, because you've seen them exist in a world outside of the core world of the book, which is the politics and the governance, you've seen them interact with other human beings, whether they're friends, brothers, parents, spouses, whatever the case is. You've seen them exist in this familial way. It humanizes them a lot more for you, and you understand them so much better as a result. So I'm curious as to what informed the choice or the choices behind writing a book that the major inspirations behind the story are about governance and are about politics and about the history of our country, Nigeria, but then somehow in the weaving of the narrative, you create all this like one-on-one conversations and relationships that add shade and texture and flavor to the book. So like how did that come to be?
Well, I think several things happened. First, I think it's important to not write a textbook when you're writing a novel. And if I didn't create characters and put them in situations and show them in a multidimensional way, or show them through and through, with subtext, I would be writing a textbook that says, you know, if you read any textbook on Nigerian history, it will tell you Tafa Balewa was the first Prime Minister of Nigeria, and Nana Azikiwe was the first Governor General, Indigenous Governor General, and then first President after 63, my Republican Constitution. So, but you don't know what they were really like. All you hear is, oh, they like tea, or this one went to the US, or this one had the golden voice, or this one was. But you don't know anything about them apart from what they did. So that's a textbook. And the textbook has its places, absolutely. I mean, to know your history is to read textbooks or watch documentaries or to get into the factual nature of things. But writing a novel, I wasn't interested in writing that part of history. I wanted to show human beings and characters that you could, that breathe, that that are alive that show you the context of their decisions and not just their decisions or their choices. And so that was more important. So it's not a book that is descriptive of politics and governance. It just shows it in relation to the characters. And the characters in novels, I would argue, are always the most important part of that, of the experience. Because what you remember in the stories is who they were, not even what they did particularly. In many stories, you remember, oh, this person did, this person, this is who this person was. And you describe them in that sense. You say, oh, yeah, this guy is like this, or this guy, this was his motivation. Regardless of what, how many things they did in the book, you remember the major thing they did, but you remember everything that they did. So it was conscious on my part to write a story that people could read and connect with characters that they could see breathing and living in an imagined space. And that is the whole construct of the novel, I think. It's supposed to put you in a place in your own imagination where you can imagine people, and they have to be breathing, living people, and not just, oh, Richard was sworn in and he went to the door and he signed the bill. That's what it would sound like with our characters. So that's where that came from.
Okay. So you've mentioned the West Wing already, which I think if anyone who has seen the show and then goes on to read the book will probably understand that connection straight away. And even from your description, the connection is very clear. But I don't, we've spoken already in passing about Dune, the books. And subsequently the movies, however you feel about those, and the inspirations that you drew from Dune when you were creating this, or the impact that Dune had on you that affected the creation of 8 Years. So I want to know a little bit more about that because I think that's a less obvious parallel to draw, and I'm interested in finding out, what those like little seeds from Dune were that grew into trees in 8 years, if you get what I mean.
Okay, so I think for Dune, when I was thinking of this book, and I think it's one of the ways I write, in which I think about a book for a long time before I start writing, and I'm always actively thinking about it. So in a sense, I'm writing the book in my head already, and there's a lot of influences I take from other sources to try and get my mind state into the kind of thing I'm trying to create at that moment. So I remember I was reading, not just Dune, but I was reading, I'd read Anthos of Savannah, of course, and I'd read Ibadan by Wole Soyinka, and I'd read Guest of Honor by Nadine Gordimer, and those explain democracy African style, more or less. And they explain the troubles of, even though they are mostly 60s, 70s issues, but they explain the some of the history that has gone behind the modern African state and all its problems and all its complexities. And people, we very quickly forget the context of the problem with democracy in our country or in our or on our continent and where it came from and all its roots and why it's sort of damaged or problematic or not, or doesn't fit into any mold. The fit into any mold is an argument for another day, but I'm not going to that. But so just in reading those books, I was thinking of the environment in which this book is placed. Like, let's say, even if you add Ben Okri and the Famish Road and what he was speaking about military dictatorship in Nigeria, the subtext of that book was about, what the sort of domination of parochial systems in the African state around that time. And so you have a thread from the 60s to the 70s to the 80s and then to the 90s and then to the noughties, as you call them. So that I thought of 8 years as a continuation of that tradition of speaking to the context of democracy in Africa, and specifically in Nigeria, all the things it will culminate in, not to write a textbook, like I said, but to write an actual living story that people can relate to. Where Frank Herbert's Dune comes in is because in constructing particularly the main character, Williams, I was thinking of the idea of a hero. And Dune is funny because Dune is about Paul Atreides, and there are many ways to conceive of what that book means. One of the ways to look at it is that Frank Herbert was thinking of Joseph Campbell and the hero of many faces, and the idea that the hero is a problem, not a solution. And that many dictators, many tyrants, many genocidal maniacs think of themselves as heroic in a sense. And in a sense, if you read Dune and Dune Messiah and Children of the Dune, I think that's what it's called. Those three books are probably the best ones. The first three. And the trajectory of Paul Atreides from the normal hero rising from the ashes of his misfortune to defeat a foe morphs very quickly in Dune Messiah into his universe or universal jihad, as it's called in the book, has killed over billions of people because he has seen a vision of what the future might be like if he didn't suppress it under his will.
Mm.
And that idea of what a hero will do in order to achieve an aim that he sees by his own vision, not by anybody else's vision.
Mm.
And his vision is the one you see because he's the center of the story.
Mm.
But it doesn't mean that that's the only path. It's just the path that he sees. And that idea interested me. And that character was who I was trying to build in William. And so that's why Dune is important to the book that I've written. Not to go into spoilers, but that idea is very well in the book, that he sees it one way and he pursues that end as a hero.
Mm.
And he takes the heroic journey, even though our heroic journey is more subtext and is explained throughout in bits and pieces, because he has already arrived at the point where he has conquered his foe and he's standing at the center of power. And his journey is just continual. He's already in the sense of the Dune books, he's already in Dune Messiah. His house, Atreides, has lifted itself out of the gloom and is now on top. What is he going to do now? But that heroic journey is where Dune is, because it's interesting, because many people read it and think, like, no, what Dune is it's simple. He's taken to Arrakis with his father. His father gets killed. He escapes. I'm not spoiling Dune for anybody, but I mean, if you're not, you read Dune by now. He was basically 60, so grow up.
Wow. Spoilers abound, guys. Yeah.
So he rises from those ashes. But what he does next, because if you read Dune and end it in Dune, and you don't read Dune Messiah or Children of Dune and go on, you think, oh, he's a good guy.
Yeah.
But the more you go on, the more you see different aspects of that character. And that's what Dune is so central to, as well as the books I've mentioned before, it's so central to the conception of that character. And it's one of the reasons why it's not going to be one book. It's one of the reasons why it's a series, because I want to explore that idea of the hero's journey after the denouement of his victory, not before.
Hmm. Okay. Well, the other thing I really enjoyed about the book, but also found, I mean, from the perspective of a writer, I try to stay away from fact as much as possible when I'm writing.
Yeah.
Because out of pure laziness for me personally, I don't want to cross-check anything. I don't want to think about, oh, did this actually happen in that time, whatever the case is. So it was very intriguing to me to read your book, where you wrote a book that really interweaves fact with fiction. Because, like you've mentioned, it's set in Nigeria, our country. It's set in 2011, with very real elements of what was going on around that period. Sort of finding their way into the narrative of the book. You follow more or less the same trajectory of our political and government structures, in terms of how, like, what's the hierarchy is, who is where, that kind of thing. Even when we make references in the book where you see the character's journey out of Nigeria, they're not journeying into a fictional outside Nigeria. They're journeying into countries that existed in a similar way at that time.
Yeah.
So real stories find their way into, and real elements of fact, rather, find their way into the narrative of the book. So because for me, as a lazy writer, as I've already mentioned, I don't really want to have to figure out where is the fact, where is the fiction, where do they meld? I'm really curious as to how you made those choices. Why did you even, first of all, say you wanted to do it this way, instead of just, you could have created a completely fictional country with a completely fictional structure. Like, you could have built your whole world, like, Tolkien-esque.
Yeah.
Why did you choose to do it this way, where you interwove it with our reality and our history, and why, how did you draw the line in between both things, and like, where did they meet, where did they diverge, how did you make those choices?
Okay, so the first part of that is, I'm not, the book is a love letter to Nigerian democracy, to the idea of Nigerian democracy and what we have and can make of it. That's my shtick in that sense. Fiction is the art of possibility. So I'm always trying to put in the idea of what is possible, but I want to put it inside the context of what we have. Because if you don't see a line, if you do fantasy, if you take Lord of the Rings, for example, as I've used an example, there's the hobbits, and there's humans, and there's elves, and there's orcs, and there's all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there's wizards, and there's dwarves, and all that stuff. The whatever message, and Tolkien was very clear that he had no message in that sense, but the message sort of seeps in that there's a ring that has corrupted, and a pure heart must take it and jump it into the fires of Mordor. And that's the trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it's saying, the safety is that it's not in the real world.
Mm.
I'm not sure that we have that. What's the word I'm looking for?
Luxury.
Luxury. That's what I'm looking for. So when we're addressing governance or politics in Nigeria or anywhere else in the third world, to separate ourselves that much from the reality that is occurring. And there are many things that happened in 2011 that were still feeling the effects of today. And I wanted to draw that parallel between this is what happens, and this is what happened, and this is what could have happened, and this is what a progressive president would do, and this is how even a progressive president would make a mistake.
Mm.
And this is how, because it's not a, when I say progressive, I don't mean it in the general, I mean it in the very political sense of progressive politics.
Mm.
So I don't mean it in the sense of, oh, he's going to be right, or he's some kind of telepath, or some kind of genius that has all the answers. But I just wanted to explore the art of the possible. And the best way to do that is to show this is at the facts, and within the facts, draw out storylines that show the multiplicity of choices that could have been made and where it would have led to. Not that it would always lead to a good end or a bad end, but just that we have the possibility to make all these other choices. And so it was important in that sense to start with fact, to say, this is what happened. This was 2011. These are the things that happened. This is what the world was. This was what happened in Libya. This was happening in Japan. This was happening in South Africa. This was happening around the world. And this is the context in which Nigeria saw those challenges. And this is how Nigeria approached it within the fictional realm that we have created, that is not removed from the possible, which is the part in fiction. I was more interested in what is possible from that fiction. So I couldn't do Middle Earth. I had to do Nigeria. And that's why the fact is important, to show you that this is Nigeria, this is our country, this is what happened, this is what we're dealing with, this is what we're still dealing with. And this is the art of the possible in terms of that. But I think, honestly believe that human progress is based on fiction. It's based, not fiction in the, even in narrative sense, it's based on the idea of what is possible.
Mm.
Where can we go from this place that we're here? And that is what I hope is at the root of the love letter.
Speaking of love letters, I happen to know personally, just me, and maybe like 10 other people in the world, that this is not the only thing you write. You're not just Mr. Foye Samson Bano, writer of political fiction.
Yeah.
So while we round up today's little segment, I want you to talk a little bit about what is to come.
Okay.
We know, obviously, since this is volume one in the series for 8 years, that there's going to be volume two eventually. But outside of that, what else can we expect from the writer that is Mr. Foye Samson Bano?
Well, okay, so this is my debut novel, but it's definitely not the first book I've written. I think I have 5 books before this. It's probably the sixth book I've written. The context of it coming out first is more to do with when we were ready to launch our thing and to push out a story that we thought would be timely. At the thing, and political fiction is the last thing I wrote. I'd not even attempted it before I wrote it, so it's not where I would say my more natural sensibilities lie in that sense. But yeah, so I mostly write metafiction, which is more abstract and more metaphysical in the sense that it deals with more spiritual themes and goes into the areas of existentialism. Is that how to pronounce words?
Don't ask me how to pronounce
existentialism
words.
And that sort of world where we worry, not worry, but we grapple with what it means to be human before anything else, and what our origins are, not from a scientific point of view, but from a spiritual point of view. Like, what does this mean? What is the meaning and purpose of life on Earth through the prism of characters and their experiences on Earth? So that's more my thing than political. So, but also I've been a long, lifelong fan of Stephen King, and I love genre fiction, even probably more than literary fiction. No, that's not true. But I mean, I defend genre fiction for being having its place in our reading, and so it was, while metafiction seems more like literary fiction, and this seems more like genre fiction, to me, the writing is the same, and the process is the same, and I'm not toning down on either one to make one seem more like me or not. So in that sense, maybe I should stop saying that I'm not a political fiction writer because I've written that book. And yeah, so hopefully over the course of the next few years, while we're exploring this series in politics, there will also be books that are more akin. I feel like I'm describing this very badly.
It's a theme today.
Yeah. But yeah, so I write about God and what that means to us. That's my own particular brand of metafiction to an individual sense, and not even at all within the prism of or prison.
Rather,
not offend anybody, or organized religion and how people connect with it, but just that has always been the number one question on my mind as a human being, where we come from in the spiritual sense, and figuring that out over the course of your life is where most of my fiction comes from, or so far. But also, and then also, you can see clearly from this the governance concerns. So those are basically my twin commitments in writing: the idea of where we come from and the idea of what it is to be a Nigerian, and all the things that come with that and govern our existence in a more physical sense. So yeah, those are the kinds of books I'm guessing, or well, I know you'll be reading from my particular bookstore. God and Nigeria.
Oh, I mean, that's that final summary really captures it all. God and Nigeria. But okay, so we have spoken about the book in detail. We've spoken about what's to come. I think now that we've gone through this entire journey of talking about the book, I think you might be ready to take another, you know, have another attempt at describing what this book is.
I did that badly the first time.
You did it badly. I was thinking about it while we were talking throughout the process of this episode, and I thought, I'm actually intrigued as to your initial, when someone asks you if you're just walking down the street, what's your book about?
Yeah.
Like your initial response. And then after sitting and talking to them about it for a period of time, if they go, so what's your book about?
What was it?
What you would say.
Okay. So let me attempt. 8 years is a love letter to Nigerian democracy. It starts in 2011 or 2011, depending on which side of that argument you stand. Numerically, it's a day-to-day look, 365 days. So it goes from 2011 May to 2012 May of a progressive, what I believe is a progressive Nigerian presidency. Progressive in the political sense, not in the party affiliation sense. Let me say in the ideological sense, because I'll get into trouble saying progressive because it's a party progressive that I'm affiliated with. So, yeah. And it charts the course of a president trying to grapple with a country in crisis and how he reacts to that crisis and what he learns from that and how he doesn't lose his empathy for people along the way, which is the strongest thing. And so that's what the book is. And I hope to show a multi-character, multi-dimensional look at what it is like to be inside a Nigerian presidency in this particular year. Not that I know any of that, but the book knows all, as they say.
Okay, so that brings us very nicely to the end of today's episode. As always, let me plug all our things. You can find us online at www.logiabooks.ng. You can also find us on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram at Logia Books. We have been live on our website for a few days now. We've been releasing regular excerpts from 8 Years by Fori Samson Banu on a daily basis, so you can always find a copy of that and read it, and we'll continue to do that throughout the year. The full book in all its glory is available from Monday, 12th of June, 2023, and you'll be able to purchase it and read the ebook online at that point. So, did I miss anything?
Nope. That's a perfect summary.
So, yeah, that's where we're at. Once 8 Years is out, we're going to be telling you a lot more about some of our other writers. We're going to be having more of these conversations, and I cannot wait to share that with you. But for now, that's us. We're out.
Bye.